This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource at thebdr.net. That's THEBDR.net.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
You know, I've gotten a couple of emails saying, really like the show, wish it was shorter.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? All your bases are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
Chris Tobin is here dressed in a tuxedo. Tom Ray barely made it in the studio. Chris Tarr is here and Al Neller from Nautel.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hi, everybody, and welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, Twirt. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. And joining me today, a bevy of other top-notch engineers and a top-notch guest as well. Welcome into episode number 7 here. And as I said, I'm Kirk. I'm the International Business Development Director for Telos, Omnia, and Axia. That's my disclaimer. I have a background in broadcast engineering, and I'm still part owner of four radio stations in the U.S., two in Mississippi and two in American Samoa. So I own the part that doesn't make any money, so I certainly know a lot about broadcasting on a budget. Also joining us on the show today, we have some regulars. One of them is Tom Ray from New York City. Hello, Tom.
Actually, I'm more unusual than not. Hello, Kirk. How you doing?
I'm good. Tom, tell us what you do. Give us your disclaimer here.
Well, I sing. I'm Vice President of Engineering for Buckley Broadcasting and WOR Radio in New York City.
Well, good. Glad to have you in. Chris Tobin is with us also in the Big Apple. Hi, Chris.
Hello there, Kirk. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Tell us about what you're doing.
My job is broadcast technologist at the CBS Radio Group in New York City, and my job is to find technologies that help us make money.
Oh.
That's right.
Oh.
I try to introduce a return on investment with technology.
Well, if you have good news, you're in all the high-level meetings.
Well, sometimes it's just way too many meetings. That's the problem.
I can only imagine.
A meeting on a meeting.
Also, along with us is the Geek Jedi himself, Chris Tarr from Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hi there.
Hi, glad to have you in. Tell us what you do, Chris.
I am a mad scientist and worthy adversary. And then, in my spare time, I'm the director of engineering for Intercom in Milwaukee and Madison.
I'll consider the first part to be the disclaimer and where your interests lie. Hey, and also joining us for the entire show, we have a special guest, but he was able to join us for the whole show and not just for the second half of the show. And that would be Hal Neller with Nautel. Hi, Hal.
Hello, Kirk. How's everyone tonight?
We're good. And where are you calling in from? Where do you call home these days?
Punta Gorda, Florida. I get to work out of my house and do my market development manager job for Nautel with a laptop, a BlackBerry, and an IP phone.
So you do work for Nautel, and you said you're a market development manager. What does that mean?
Correct. Well, I guess I could call it business development of sort, but I also help in marketing, help with the sales guys, do some show support for trade shows internationally and domestically, pretty much a generalist in the sales and marketing department to help out whatever needs to get done.
All right. Well, on this show, we've got a couple of topical things to talk about, and one of those is a report that I just read. It's come out. It's in both of the major industry trade magazines, Radio World and Radio Magazine. I would imagine we might read a blurb about it, too, in Radio Guide. And that is a company by the name of Future Source Consulting. Future Source says that Internet radio will drive more home networking and also internet radio products. Now, I don't know. Maybe I can go along with that, and maybe not. So again, they're saying that station streaming and the availability of radio stations on the internet and people wanting to listen to that at home is going to actually drive their decisions about home networking and well, naturally buying internet radio products. Does that sound like a likely scenario?
I can't believe that it would. No, I just for the end user. Home networking, they're going to be more interested in email, internet, web surfing. I can't see internet radio being a driving force. That's
I got to agree with Chris on that, too. I think the driving force with home networking is going to be video. I think that's the killer app, like
exactly.
the Netflix and things like that. I think radio, internet radio, come along for the ride, but I can't see anybody going out and making that sort of investment for internet radio.
No, not at all. And I don't think many homeowners would know what to do with their home network.
Yeah, but you have to keep in mind, radio as what we know it as, people use it as a utility, or you know, it's like a coffee maker in a kitchen. It has a specific use, purpose, need, desire, entry into your world. Whereas video television is sort of like, it's just, hey, it's entertainment. It's something, hey, I'm going to go for that right now because it excites my visual nerves. But radio is a more forward, in the front of mind thinking. It requires more thought, and I don't think that's going to drive it.
Well, and I think, too, and actually we're kind of seeing this with HD radio, because radio is such a utility, you really don't see people making that kind of investment until it's time to replace something that's breaking or,
exactly.
you know, that sort of thing. So I don't see somebody spending that kind of money to create the infrastructure for internet radio. But I see if it's part of a different project or a different thing that they're trying to do to tack that on at the end, just like with HD radio, if you're going to buy a new one, might as well get the one with HD with it.
Sure, definitely.
And the network infrastructure seems to be getting so common today in people's homes anyway, with laptops and you know, other devices that use the infrastructure. So I wonder how internet radio is going to actually drive that. It may be an appliance that connects onto it, but I'm not sure that it's going to force it.
And how would your network be any different anyway to add a radio appliance? Of course, I'm kind of a networking geek like a lot of folks. Perhaps on this show, but I've got two different access points to cover the house, and I've also got a Roku sound bridge in the bedroom. And I didn't build the network for the Roku, but the Roku certainly wirelessly ties it into the network.
So here. I've got two wireless access points in the house, and not a Roku. It's what the heck is? I don't even know what it is. But I've got an internet radio in the bedroom, and I carry it around the house and. You know,
yeah, I think the Wi-Fi enabled devices are becoming more prevalent, and the ease of use is just going to create the need. But for internet radio, it's still going to be the content, unless really compelling. I don't think people are going to go crazy buying a sound bridge and go, oh, there we go, and build a network around it.
Well, I'm still, you know, I got to get rid of my dial-up, but I use a media server, and there's actually a free media server out there called Tiversity. And it's mainly for streaming video, but it also does audio. So, you know, all of my devices, laptops, my TV does do, connect to a home media server. I can stream audio, video, all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I think that, you know, that's really on the geek side. But with the Rokus and the sound bridges and things, those are becoming more and more common. And with Wi-Fi, it's so easy to set up and run. So and it's more like it is a utility.
Yeah. Chris, tell me about this TV that attaches to your network. How does that work?
Well, it's the TV we were talking about earlier. It doesn't have a hard drive in it, but it does connect directly to a media server. It can see media server, which has kind of gotten to a standard across platforms in terms of how these media servers work and interact. So I can bring up a screen that tells me all the media that I have loaded and stream it to the television or to any other device that connects to it. And all the server is a computer running software. And I have, you know, my audio, my video. I have some plugins that will, you know, grab streaming audio and convert it. And basically what the server does is it just acts as a transcoder, you know, takes the stream coming from wherever, changes it, restreams it into a format that my devices can understand and, you know, allows me to watch all of this content, YouTube, you know, Netflix, all that stuff, wherever I am in the house. And I think we're going to see more and more of that with the televisions coming out. In fact, a lot of Blu-ray players do it now.
Folks, I promise we'll get back to radio at some point here. Chris, I'm curious about something because I have a couple of times tried to build up a Mythbuntu server and a Windows Media server, and I've just given up before I found out all about it. But your diversity software enabled server, does this let you get programs, say, via IP off the internet and then watch those when you want to? Or is this all things that you have to rip into the server yourself?
No, it'll actually cache data. You know, if for example, I take the RSS feed for CNN and CBS News and stuff, and it'll actually every hour pull it down and save it. And then I can call it up later on and watch it. It doesn't do like caching of Hulu, but it will do Hulu in real time. So you can watch Hulu just as if you're watching TV and, you know, stuff like that. Now, the nice thing is it's real easy to run. It's just a program that runs on any Windows computer. You'll need some, you know, you'll need some horsepower for the transcoding, but it's free and it's real easy to set up and run. You just load the program up, click run. And if you have these devices that can see, you know, Media Center PCs, it'll see it and start talking and playing the content.
So your TV can natively see that.
Yeah, well, my TV can. I also have a DirecTV DVR that can see it. And I even have an older, my Xbox 360 can see it and play the content as well.
And the name of the software again?
It's Tversity, T-V-E-R-S-I-T-Y.
And Tversity. Gotcha.
Yes, and the website's tversity.org if you'd like to download it.
So how does the television actually connect to the network?
The television, it's IP-enabled. You just throw a network connection into it.
Okay. And, so it's not wireless. It's actually done with a Cat 5.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things will work with wireless devices, but there's still just not enough bandwidth in wireless for the HD content. So, you know, if you're throwing SD content at it, it works fine. But you really start to get that detailed HD content, and it chokes. So a lot of these will give you either or. You know, a lot of the Media Center devices will give you wireless and wired, and, you know, wired is obviously the better way to go. But the way this works, it auto-discovers. So you turn it on, and with the standard that they have for media servers, the TV turns on and says, hey, any media servers here? And the media server says, yep, I'm here. And it shows up on a list. You click on it, and then it goes, okay, here's your content. Here's the menu. And pick what you want and watch it.
Which brand television are you using?
This is it's a new Samsung, and I believe I don't remember. There's another brand that's just come out that has that too. It does the Media Connect, I think is what they call it.
Wow. I suppose that because there's more money and more interest in television than in radio, especially in the home, I suppose that television products are well ahead of where radio products are in this kind of realm.
You know, I don't think so. You know, if you look at the Roku and the SoundBridge devices, and I believe there's somebody else who just came out with one too, I think those are actually a little more prevalent just because there seems to be less of a kind of a mental barrier to that. You know, people look
they're easy to set up.
Yeah. You look at an internet radio, it's wireless, turn it on, it works. Video is a little more complicated, especially with transcoding and, you know, it really, there's still a huge learning curve there if you're trying to do stream video like that.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think with the video, the hardest part is trying to give you a stutter-free video with a quick, easy out of the box, plug it in and go. The Roku, the radio, internet radio devices are literally plug them in, turn them on, select the radio station from around the world, and you're off and running. Video, Chris is right, there's still more going on.
Well, either on this podcast or maybe on a future one, I also want to cover a subject that Skip Peasy has talked about in Radio World, and a few of our listeners have asked about it, and that's something called Radio DNS. This is apparently a number of technologies, including an electronic program guide for radio, which I think would be just absolutely fantastic. Something called Radio VIS, which is transmission of images and text that support broadcast audio services, and also Radio Tag, and that's listener tagging of specific program elements such as songs or promos or news items for later recall and then detailed reference perhaps when they get home if they do this while they're in the car. Anybody on the panel here familiar with Radio DNS and this kind of technology?
No, just what I've read in Radio World.
Yeah, same here.
Well, I think we'd all do well to, you know what, we ought to have Skip Peasy on the show. I talked to him at the AES convention in New York a couple months ago, and he certainly agreed to be on the show. He did a article in Radio World called The Boombox with a Browser Arrives, and this was in the October 27th Radio World. You can see it online at rwonline.com. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. So you can kind of get educated on that. We'll bring Skip in on a future show to tell us about that. I think that would be just absolutely awesome. So somehow on my radio or maybe a radio in the future with a bit of a screen on it, I could see a show that I forgot about, or I could, you know, scroll through and just see what was coming up on a station, especially a talk station, I suppose. Any ideas as to if that would be helpful to your own operations?
I think it would be, and I think if I'm not mistaken, they're working on something like that, a radio program guide with HD radio. I think it would be great. I mean, satellite radio already has that. You can go in and take a look at things and see what's on the other channels and see if there's anything you're interested in.
I think
go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say it's an excellent tool for stations to promote upcoming things topic-wise in the stations that I work with, which are all news and sports. Something happening in the world of news or sports, you can preload it, so to speak, up front and say, hey, coming up in the next couple of minutes, the story on X, Y, and Z gives people a little, it's a little enticing, a little bit of a hook.
The HD radio program guide is on beta test in the Boston Providence market right now.
I'm wondering how the program directors, especially music stations like that, though. I would think that would drive them nuts.
It'll drive the ones who are still thinking in a linear manner nuts.
Right, right.
But those who are thinking more in the world of what's going on around them and saying, okay, the mold is broken, the paradigm shift has taken place, this is definitely something I need to get my head around, those are the ones you're going to see come out and do something with it, which will probably be the markets outside of the top 50.
Yeah.
Well, apparently, if you want to go to a website, radiodns.org, this group just held a conference in Geneva, Switzerland, on talking about some standards for these technologies and how they can work together. Some of the people involved with this drafting team at Radio DNS, and again, in a future show, we'll get somebody on who really knows about this. But for example, Jeff Littlejohn of Clear Channel in the U.S. is on this team. James Cridland from a company called Not At All Bad in the UK is on it. Nick Piggott is on it. He features prominently in a number of the programs that were held just about a week ago in Geneva. So I'm interested in this. We'll get some more information on this and get it on a future show. Let's kind of turn our attention to Hal Neller and give some questions and answers to and from Hal about HD radio. Hal, understand you did used to work for Ibiquity, isn't that right?
That's right. I did international broadcast business development for Ibiquity.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working outside the U.S. Spreading the HD radio concept to other countries.
So HD radio certainly has been accepted by broadcasters here. Quite a number of them, around 1,000 have put this on the air.
Actually, almost 2,000.
Oh my goodness, it's almost 2,000. Well, how's this going around the world? HD radio, as compared to some of the other technologies available.
In pockets, in places, it's going well. There's some minor successes where it's been adopted as the official standard in some small countries, like Panama, for example. And then there are some very large countries looking at it. Mexico has already allowed HD radio technology to be broadcasting along that region of 200 miles from the from the U.S. border south into Mexico. Any station there that wishes to run HD radio may do so, and they've got about a dozen on the air. They're in a study now to determine the overall digital system for radio that will be used in Mexico. Probably the fact that HD radio is already operating in the country, gives it a good leg up to further adoption. China is studying it. South Korea is studying it. It's the standard officially in the Philippines. It's been tested in a number of countries, Indonesia, Vietnam. I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but a good number of Asian countries are running broadcasts right now on an experimental basis. Mm-hmm. About a dozen stations are on the air in the Philippines by now.
Hmm. As an engineer myself who gets an opportunity to travel around the world, I'm in favor of digital technologies, because I know there's more that we can do with digital technologies than we can with analog technologies. Certainly a lot of engineers, probably a few on the show here, including myself to some degree, we do hearken back to the old days where we could use a crystal radio and pick up the local AM station and enjoy radio that way. I think those days are changing, and we're moving ahead into digital technologies. Hal, what are some of the other technologies around the world that are competitors to HD radio? What are some of the other countries adopting here and there, or at least looking at?
Europe is very much oriented to the DAB, or the Eureka 147, as it's also known, digital audio broadcasting. The public broadcasters, and, you know, the name's a little different, the nomenclatures, but like BBC in the UK or CBC in Canada would be what they would call a public broadcaster, as opposed to, say, a Clear Channel or a Buckley that might be what we would call a private broadcaster in Europe. So the public broadcasters in virtually all the European nations have banded together to move to the DAB format, actually the DAB Plus format. The only difference is the codec is more efficient than the original MPEG layer 2 that they used years ago, because you have a movement in technology now. They can get many more channels of audio in the same 1.5 megahertz of bandwidth than they could with the old system. So we have the UK, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Spain on across, all migrating into this this technology. Some of the medium wave stations and shortwave stations have been embracing something called DRM, Digital Radio Mundial, which an experiment is going on in our country in Alaska to see whether or not DRM might be a good method to cover a vast area with minimum population. Original AM or FM broadcast station cannot. So DRM originally was a shortwave digital replacement technology. Mm-hmm. It's migrated to medium wave AM, as we call it in the US, and now they have also come up with a system for a digital only FM system, not like HD radio, which is a hybrid system,
right?
Analog and digital on the same basic channel, but this is a digital only that fits on a channel. So those are the two basic systems. And, of course, there's some, you know, rollouts of that in other countries as well. Canada had a failed attempt at Eureka 147. It's pretty much been discontinued up there. But some Asia countries engaged in it, too. So it does have, you know, some traction around it.
Are there some countries that are taking the television technology, DVB, and using it for radio broadcasting? I thought I heard that there was, is it called DVB-H for handheld?
Yes, but those are mostly mobile video formats. And I'm not aware of a whole lot. Now, there was at the Harris booth at the NAB, they showed an ATSC mobile video demonstration showing some radio channels in the data portion there that could evolve eventually into another mobile standard in the U.S., a digital standard. But most of these guys, what they did in Europe, in places where the DAB wasn't taking off, was they converted it to mobile video formats, DMB and stuff like that. So we're not seeing a lot of radio in some of these other video formats, like Korea, for example. Very big mobile video, 12 million handheld sets have been sold in that country. People walking around with things that look like iPhones, but they're watching television on it. They don't do radio on it.
You know, maybe my other co-host can chime in on this, but it seems like we're at this. I think it's a rather uncomfortable. It's exciting, but it's a rather uncomfortable point in technology where we have a lot of choices as to where we can go. No matter what country you're in, maybe you have different preferences or different political alliances, but you have different ways that you can go. And I'm even thinking of a future where we have radios and televisions that are picking up WiMAX and LTE, where we actually have some very convenient interactivity, not out-of-band interactivity, not a return channel that's something else, but an in-band return channel where you have a cellular system of WiMAX or LTE cell points around a populated area, and you can listen to radio and have instant interactivity with the content provider if they want to allow that. Same thing with television content providers. And that kind of interactivity is definitely going to be harder to do with broadcast style technologies where you have generally one centrally located transmitter. It seems like the back channel would be more difficult to do. And do we need all this technology? Are consumers wanting this kind of thing? I don't know. What if you had a radio that had a screen on it that you had a choice give you a choice of five songs as and to which one you want to hear next, and you vote for your favorite song, and of course there may be some little ad from Ford or Coca-Cola associated with each of the of those songs. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here. Tom, Chris, and Chris, any thoughts on this kind of tech going forward?
Well, you know, some of those things, like you just described with pick your favorite songs, there are some online music services that already do that, where you can program your own radio station. The popularity of those, I don't know. I mean, personally, they drive me kind of nuts. I wouldn't personally be sitting down at a computer or whatever and picking out, Tom's favorite hits.
You're just not that into it.
No, I work with it all day. I just, I turn it off when I come home.
we do have a back channel with HD radio technology, and now starting with RDS in this country, with iTunes tagging. Now, the back channel's a little convoluted, but if you have a tagging radio, and hundreds of radio stations now are broadcasting this iTunes coding, if you have a appropriate receiver, then you can tag a song, and then when you get your iPod or your iPhone or whatever your iDevice is, you plug it into that receiver, it sends all the codes to it, and then when you sync with the internet, it remembers what you tagged and gives you the option to buy it. That is a back channel, but it's not a real-time back channel. But in a car radio, for example, a back channel could be, you know, through a cellular phone, a Bluetooth. There's a lot of ways to create back channels in the broadcast environment that will use a different form to create that back channel.
Yeah.
Well, there's even a service now, and I wish I could remember the name of it, that's out there working with some radio stations that actually provides a back end to work with your automation system, where people can in real time vote for songs and actually have them get into the playlist. And you can do that by text messaging or going through a website, and the dates collects that data and actually can sort the playlist in real time depending on the number of votes a song gets.
That's right. Interesting. Boy, I think that would drive a programmer nuts.
Well, you might have services where a programmer, the services of a programmer is no longer needed. Weren't there services on television like that? Wasn't there a video jukebox service where you'd pay to call in and vote on a song?
Yeah, they did a bunch of LPTV transmitters in different markets. And, yeah, they called it the box. And it was music videos, and you could dial, although what their deal was, you dialed like a 900 number or something to vote. And, you know, they'd get like 50 cents a call or something. And you could program what, you know, music video came up next.
What are you thinking might happen around the world with all these different standards? Would anybody ever make a radio that worked with all of them? Or is there just not a need for that? Would you just have a radio for each country as needed with whatever their chosen standard was?
Interesting question. In the short term, there's a major European auto manufacturer whose name has been requested and not be made public, but they are coming out with a software-defined radio, and they will flash the radio based upon what region of the globe that radio, that automobile will be shipped to. So if it's coming to the U.S., it would be flashed for HD radio. If it's going to some country in Europe, it may be flashed for DAB and DRM as well as analog. So, but we're talking about, you know, one of those cars that costs a fair amount of money, not a $15,000 car.
Yeah.
As we look at the kind of devices that the average person wants to have at the average price point that they want to do, you know, a Walmart radio or something of that sort, we don't see a multi-mode receiver being very financially practical. It is technologically possible.
Gotcha. Let's turn our attention to the U.S. for a bit here and talk about this HD power increase. We covered this a bit on a previous show. This proposal to go to from a minus 20 dB level for the HD carriers. The proposal to is it minus 14?
Yes.
That's the interim compromise. The goal is to get to minus 10.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there are plenty of HD detractors out there who would be against that, but tell us what the advantages are of this power increase. What's this going to do for broadcasters? Why are they interested in it?
Primarily, it brings the coverage of the HD radio signal in parity with the analog coverage, because as most people know now, the HD signal has been less than successful in replicating the analog coverage. So it would improve automobile reception, especially with multicast, where you have no backup analog signal to fall back to. It just kind of dies. Yeah. It will improve building penetration. And the minus 14 gets you about two-thirds of the results from the maps that I looked at. Radio World published some of these maps for the different cities that were tested at the various power levels. But the minus 10 actually, in some cases, can exceed the normally protected contour of the analog station. And many of us know from experience, depending upon terrain and interference situations, you can well, for example, in a car driving down a throughway somewhere, you can well exceed the station's contour, the analog protected contour, and continue driving for miles and still enjoy the programming and still have a relatively clean, clear signal. You may not have building penetration at that point, but absent of terrain and a co-channel or a first adjacent channel interference, you can really drive some very long distances beyond a contour.
Some, from my original question, but I live in an area here in Nashville where, frankly, I'm surrounded by towers. I mean, I live within 5 or 6 miles of all the Class C stations here in Nashville. So I get perfect HD reception all the time, anywhere I go, in the usual places I go. I know this is not the case for a lot of other listeners. Chris or Tom, can you kind of give us your experiences in terms of HD coverage on your own stations?
Well, I know out here in the Midwest, you know, and that's the other thing is, I think there have been some big, significant differences. For example, on the coasts where you've got a lot of radio stations close together, a lot of short spacing going on. In the Midwest, where most stations are fully spaced. Now, my Class Bs have excellent HD coverage at the current power levels. I mean, I can go for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. On the other hand, I've got a Class A, and it's running 40 watts, I believe, in HD, and it's great. You know, real close by, but as soon as you get into, you know, just inside the city of license, it's creamed. You just can't hear it at all. So, you know, I think, people have different goals, I think, depending on the power level of their station and where they're located. Would I take a power increase? Absolutely. Has there been any complaints about the coverage of my Class Bs? Not at all, really. You know, the people who have HD radios have really had no problem getting the signal. So, you know, I think there's, you know, some discussion there, too, as to, you know, where these problems actually are. And I think, too, and certainly not to blast the increase, because I think it's a good idea. But, you know, some of the problems we're getting are because of poor HD radio installs to begin with. You know, the transmission system problems and things like that.
So
up in I'm sorry. Go ahead. Up in Connecticut, we've got our FM up there, and Connecticut's a very hilly place. We're actually looking forward to the increase. The transmitter is 19 miles from the studio, and with the car, I don't have any problems picking up the HD signal all the way to the studio and all around town and actually all the way up to the Massachusetts border. It's fine, but you take an HD radio into the building 19 miles away, that's it. No. You get the analog. And, you know, even with the New York City FMs, I mean, heck, if I go up the Palisades Parkway home or even up in New Jersey, I don't even get 30 miles out of town. I lose the HDs on all the FMs that are on Empire. So, you know, that's going to a power increase definitely is warranted.
So, Hal, you've been kind of on two of the three sides of this love triangle. You've been with Ubiquiti, and now you're with a transmitter manufacturer. I guess the only other side of that might be a station owner. How are station owners reacting to the possibility that, okay, we can increase our HD power, 6 dB for now, maybe 10 dB later, but guess what? We got to buy all new gear to make that happen.
Yes, that's a problem, especially in the economy that we're facing today. Some stations will have some headroom built into their system that they can increase the power to a certain degree. They may have a couple of dB left. Virtually no one has enough headroom in a system to boost the power from, say, the minus 20 all the way to the minus 10. I explained to some owners who said, well, how come we weren't planning for this, you know, way back when? Well, first, we didn't know about it way back when. But even if we did know about it, it's the equivalent of taking, in rough approximation, a Class A station at 6 kilowatts and comparing it to a Class B station at 50 kilowatts. Well, 60 kilowatts would be the exact ratio,
yeah.
And equalizing the antenna height. So, I mean, who at a Class A station, you know, has bought a transmitter to increase their power 10 times? They haven't. So you're right. Everyone's going to have to pretty much buy a new transmitter to go all the way. The good news on this is for the stations who have yet to convert, it's a good planning thing. They can look at what's going on and they can decide what size they want to buy because they know they're going to be able to get to 14. And then if they're going to get all the way to 10, they can buy a little bit more. Some customers have asked, well, you know, if we get to minus 14, is it going to cost a whole lot more to go that extra, you know, few dB to get to minus 10? And the answer is maybe or maybe not. We did a spreadsheet and looked at various transmitter power output levels, you know, from 500 watts on up to 30-some kilowatts. And it just depends on what your TPO is and your brand of transmitter. And assuming here a common amplifier approach where both the analog and the digital are in the same transmitter, not separate antennas or high-level combining. And we find that at certain cuts, it's not very expensive to go all the way. And in other cases, it could cost $30,000 or $40,000 more. So it just depends on what your TPO is, and we'd have to look at that on a case-by-case basis.
Chris Tobin, you back with us?
I'm back. I hope you can hear me.
So, yeah, tell us about your coverage experience with the current minus 20 dB. Does your experience mimic what Tom was telling us?
Yes. Actually, I'm not too impressed with it. Here in Manhattan, largest problem we have is traveling around the Manhattan Island itself with all the large buildings. The HD will cut in and out more often than you get when you're outside the city and in the outer boroughs and in, say, New Jersey or Connecticut, Westchester, and it gets better. But distance-wise, I would agree with Tom. I think going south, as I did the other day to Philadelphia, about 25 miles out of the city, just about 30 miles, the HD signal started to drop out. It would cut in and out on the FM. AM, it's just all over the place. So very odd. I'm not sure why, but it's all over the place.
Yeah.
So ironically, we probably are at that threshold, I guess, at the minus 20.
But, you know, 30, 35 miles, what's the 1 millivolt contour on a Class B? It's about 30, 35 miles, right?
Yes.
Yep.
But, you know, but the thing is, see, this is my biggest gripe with the concept of HD radio, not the particular technology being deployed. It doesn't mimic the experience that the average listener is accustomed to. So, you know, the FM signal is still being heard after the HD goes out. You know, if the analog FM died at 33 miles or 35 miles as a Class B in the analog world, people would accept that. HD followed suit. Okay, fine. Problem is, I can continue to listen to my Class B for another 15, 20 miles.
Exactly.
And that's what's just, you know, just disturbs me, because I get calls from listeners that are always saying, there's something wrong with my radio. I went back to the dealer and they said there's nothing wrong with it. And I asked them to explain to me, what do you experience? And that's it. It's exactly it.
Yeah, see, now we're fortunate out here in the flatlands. I literally, in my basement, have an HD radio, and I am about 35 miles away from my Class B. And in the basement with the wire antenna out of the back of the Boston Acoustics, I get HD.
Oh, my goodness.
On my Class B in the car, I go out 45 miles and get HD.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we don't have that same challenge as you guys have with the tall buildings and, you know, the signals bouncing all over the place and the, you know, the close spacing and things like that. So,
right.
You know, in our situation, it's great. We really don't have any problems with it.
The high antennas where the power is reduced, such as on the Empire State Building, Sears Tower in Chicago, when you run a Class B up high and reduce the ERP, that puts the HD radio at a greater handicap than in flat terrain where you've got, say, your 50 kilowatts at 500 feet.
Mm.
And we're noticing from my Ubiquiti days, the guys who have Class A stations particularly are going to find a major improvement in their HD coverage. And a lot of it has to do with the noise level, because the digital signal is so much closer to the noise level, the noise threshold on a Class A, or especially a Class A that's at high elevation and they're only running, say, you know, a kilowatt. Think about it. They're running a kilowatt of analog. What are they running in digital? You know, almost nothing. So these guys are the ones that are going to really see a major improvement at minus 10. And the good news for them is at that power level, the transmitters aren't going to be such an expense compared to somebody who runs, say, 30 kilowatts of TPO.
Let me do the math experiment here. A Class A FM station running a kilowatt, because they're over height, would they be running at minus 20 dB 10 watts of HD?
That's exactly right.
Wow.
And you're so close to the noise floor when you get into a big city.
Yeah, yeah. That's the case here in Nashville with actually a station that I do listen to from time to time called Lightning 100 WRLT. They're an overheight Class A. And they haven't gone HD yet because they're going to get like, 7 watts or something like that.
Yeah, see, in my situation, it's just what Hal was talking about. I've got 500-foot, 20-kilowatt Class Bs. So, for example, I'm running, 175, 200 watts on HD, whereas my Class A down in Madison is one of those real high up, real low power, and I'm running, 40 watts, and it just gets creamed. So, yeah, those are the challenges we're facing, and, one of the things I am looking forward to with the increase.
So, Hal, let's move from this power increase on to the subject of the people that you're working for now, and that's Nautel. And I suppose Nautel has been pretty much at the cutting edge of HD technology, at least moving along with the rest of the pack at the very least. Tell me what Nautel is doing with HD technology.
Well, Nautel was a little late to the party. Harrison and BE were the first two major companies in the U.S. to get going with manufacturing and selling HD radio product, and Nautel was several years late. There's some disadvantages to that. You lose market share. You lose a little traction there going in, and the other guys got, a pretty good reputation for being the HD radio experts. On the other hand, you can sure learn by a lot of mistakes. You can see what the problems are in implementations. You can see what the problems are with equipment. And Nautel was able to benefit by being the last one in and came up with some kind of interesting and clever and different ways to do it. They were also the first out with the adaptive pre-correction because they recognized the early fixed pre-correctors, I'm talking about FM here,
yeah.
were not necessarily the best way to go because changing viswires in the antenna system or other shifting parameters in the transmitter could marginalize or even eliminate the mask compliance that a transmitter with a fixed pre-corrector might have.
We've got a reasonably sophisticated, technically, audience here, but tell us about adaptive pre-correction and what does this mean and how does it work and what's the benefit of this kind of technology in transmitting an HD signal?
Sure. If we were to run the transmitter as a pure Class A linear transmitter, we wouldn't need the pre-correction. It would be pretty much what goes in comes out. It would be perfectly fine, and everything would be happy. The only problem is your power bill would be very high because those transmitters would have less than a 29% PA efficiency. And the other thing is you really limit the amount of power that you could get out of a transmitter. So you take a 10 kilowatt transmitter, for example, and you derate it down to about around 2.5 or 3 kilowatts, that's a pretty expensive box to get that power level out. So what we do is we run the amplifiers more in an AB stage where we get a higher efficiency, but they're distorted. We cannot have distortion on those OFDM digital carriers. They have to be protected. They have to be linear. Same issue they have with digital television.
Mm-hmm.
So if we know what the characteristics of the amplifier are, think about the old days of telephone line equalization when we had the phone company would provide a loop and they would put equalizers on the line so that you would at the end of the loop you'd have a gain loss but you would have a flat frequency response up to that line spec. If we knew what the phone line is doing, we can crank the correct equalization in and restore a reasonable amount of audio quality. Okay, same thing in the RF world here. If we know what the characteristics of that amplifier are, what it is, and we know exactly what kind of distortions it's going to do to the RF waveform, we can pre-distort that signal so that at the output, we basically restore it back to linearity. And amplifiers will vary from brand and from design on how they're corrected. So the early days, the manufacturers went with like a fixed equalizer or a fixed pre-corrector. at the factory, they set it up on a spectrum analyzer. They cranked it for the best possible mass compliance and flatness, and shipped the transmitter out. Parts age, things get banged around in shipment. Transistors are changed if there's a failure of an amplifier, whatever. All kinds of things happen, and this fixed pre-corrector is no longer optimal. We might have an antenna icing situation. VizWire comes up. We go out of mask. So we don't have any good way with a fixed pre-corrector to have what we would term deal with the dynamics. So along comes this dynamic pre-correction, which in this particular case in radio, Nautel was the first one to apply it in FM. And it's basically a feedback loop to the pre-corrector. It's looking at the output stage of the transmitter, and it's bringing that sample back around to the input of the exciter. And the exciter looks at it and says, okay, that's what I'm getting, but this is what I need to have. So it cranks in a different variable into this pre-corrector. And then it keeps looking at it and says, okay, something shifted again, and it readjusts the pre-corrector, and it's a constant ongoing thing. So you can change the loading on the transmitter. The line voltages can change. You can swap out amplifiers, whatever. This thing will redefine itself and maximize the performance. And of course, we noticed from some of the early days, some stations had to put some mask filters in because there were some issues in California and in Chicago where stations with second adjacent rim shots were complaining they were getting creamed by the white noise hash of the HD radio signal. Mask compliance is important for your neighbors. And that's why this adaptive pre-correction and keeping that mask well below the spec is very helpful to the band.
Does that have to do with what they called spectral regrowth?
That's what it is, yes. Spectral regrowth was the phrase that was coined for this intermod that goes on between the digital carriers and the analog carrier. And they're gonna beat with each other and have all kinds of resultant outputs. Mm. And it tends to grow into the first adjacents, basically where the carriers are, but the second and the third adjacents can be polluted with this spectral regrowth, and hence this pre-correction is what holds that down.
Hal, let me ask you a kind of a theoretical question or an operational question that I just still haven't got straight in my head. You know, when we transmit an FM signal, we really don't need any overhead in the transmitter.
No.
It's a Class C operation, a Class C amplification going on, and we don't need this overhead. But with the HD radio signal, we do need, I understand, what is it, as much as 6 dB, or is it more than that overhead?
It's at least 6 dB, and it's called peak-to-average ratio.
Peak-to-average ratio. And do we need this because statistically, at some point, we're going to get a certain number of carriers turned on? Help me understand why we need this, and isn't there something we could have done in software to mitigate the amount, or maybe we already have, to mitigate the amount of headroom needed? Because this is just an enormous penalty for transmitting this kind of data. At least as a guy buying a transmitter, it seems like I've got to buy a transmitter that's just way more capable than the power that I'm going to actually be putting out because I've got to have this headroom.
You have two issues when you operate in this digital mode. It doesn't matter whether it's a pure digital transmitter. For example, someone might use if they have a separate antenna combining system where they have their analog in one antenna, the digital in the other. That's a pure digital transmitter. Or in what we call the hybrid mode where the amplifier is taking care of both the analog and the digital. As soon as you add the digital carriers, two things happen. First, you have the mass compliance issue that we talked about. The amplifier pre-corrector can only work to a certain point, but when the amplifier gets to clipping, and as you know from audio stages, if you clip an audio stage, it generates square waves and all kinds of harmonics. Mm. So we have what we call power back off. And every manufacturer is backing off power to a certain degree to keep the amplifiers below clipping. Mm. So we can pre-correct up to the clipping point, but once we hit that clipping point, the spectrum just goes nuts because of all the instant square waves. So that's the first thing that causes a D-rate. And the second thing is this peak to average ratio, or PAPR it's called. And in the Ubiquiti system, there is some peak to average control to mitigate some of the amplifier headroom that you would have to have. But it's in some people's mind, It should have been more. So Nautel did a paper a couple of years ago at the NAB. There's a fellow there named Philip Schmidt, who is kind of the HD radio genius at Nautel. And I think each one of the manufacturers seems to have their own HD radio guru, and Philip is the one there at Nautel. He did a paper and demonstrated how you could alter the waveform and play with the peak-to-average ratio and both improve the efficiency of the amplifier, which would reduce your electric bill, at the same time that you could generate up to maybe 15 to 20% more power out of the same amplifier. And this is a product that eventually will be productized at Nautel, but it's not out there now. So, yes, there are some things we can do to make it better. But as long as we're running digital, we will never be able to have the efficiency or the power output of that amplifier stage that we do in analog. And typically, just to give you an idea, at minus 20 dB, we have about a 80% recovery there from what we would have if we were an analog. So a 10 kilowatt transmitter, just for easy math, is down somewhere around 8,000 watts of analog plus minus 20. And that's going to drop down to about 40% of that number, or less than half of that. So we're going to be down around 4 kilowatts and change at minus 10.
I remember what I wanted to ask you from earlier. This this HD power increase up to a compromise level of minus 14. First question is it optional for people, or are they going to be required to do this? And second of all, what if you have two antennas, one for your analog and one for your HD? Will you still be allowed to go up in power on the HD?
Yes. The second antenna situation has a separate ramification. We have to watch isolation, because we really need to have close to 40 dB of isolation between the analog and the digital transmitter to meet mask and hold down the spectral regrowth, as you mentioned before. If we start cranking up the digital power, we actually need to increase the isolation so that we stay safe there. And people use spacing as one way to isolate. So if you have your bays a certain distance apart, some have mounted the HD antenna upside down so that the polarization is opposite, and we have a certain amount of cross-pole rejection right there, and that's a help. And some stations have found they need to install circulators. So we have to keep that in mind when we crank up the power. But from a standpoint of transmitter, if you've got a separate antenna and you've got headroom left in your transmitter, your HD transmitter, you just crank it up. Of course, don't do it yet until the FCC approves this. It's not approved yet, and that's something everybody needs to understand. This is an industry consensus that has gone to the FCC, and now the FCC has to bless it. And I'm sorry, Kurt, I got carried away on this. What was your first question on the...
Anybody else remember what my first question was? No? Okay, everybody's asleep.
No.
Actually, Hal, I wanted to move to a different question about something that someone from Nautel came and spoke to an SBE meeting that we had here in Nashville, and it had to do with, I think, what you guys call this reliable HD transport suite, something that Nautel offers. What does that mean, this reliable HD transport suite?
Yes, that is an option that is available in Nautel transmitters, but it's also a box that a station that is not a Nautel customer could purchase and use in their station. If you're using the XGen system of HD radio, which is typically where you would locate the exporter and the importer at your studio, and you would relay via an IP link to the transmitter site, if you lose a packet, you lose a couple of seconds of audio. And almost nobody's system is perfect in terms of STL, packet loss, whatever. So it could punch holes in your system.
Yeah, these packets of the actual HD to be transmitted signal? This is the
yes.
encoded signal ready to go to the transmitter?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And a lot of customers are using, for example, the mostly Starlink with the IP card in it. as one popular way to go. If you're running a 950 STL, that's typically how it's being done. So what this reliable HD radio transport does is introduces a little bit more buffering into the system, but then has a feedback loop with another IP connection. It could be like a Mosley LAN link. It could be the public internet. It could be any way that you can get an IP feed back to the studio site. And what it does is it looks at what's coming over the system, and it error checks it. And if there's a bad packet or a lost packet, it has time to do a retransmit, and we therefore save this couple second hole that would normally be popped in the program. Mm. Now, the only problem is when Ibiquiti came out with version 4.something from the previous 3.something, is we got it going again in the Nautel native broadcast equipment, but the external box that customers who have purchased that external box to run on a different brand of transmitter, they haven't got that one fixed yet. And it was a fundamental change in the bitstream that Ibiquiti made that broke it. You see, because we're not always privy to what Ibiquiti's doing to the bitstream until we get it. So they kind of have to reverse engineer a little bit to get this back on track for those guys. And the only reason you'd have to go to version 4 right now would be if you wanted to use the new embedded exporter product, for example. That has to be in that version.
Guys, we're pushing up against the end of an hour. Tom, Chris Tarr, do you have any last questions for Hal to answer in our last few minutes?
I have some. This is Chris Tobin in New York. Hey, Hal, with the HD radio receivers in the field, whether it be portable, the few that are starting to come out, or in the mobile environment or desktop, tabletop, if you have too much RF, say in the case of here in New York City, where you know the city grade signal is pounding down on folks within a 3 or 4 mile radius of the Empire State Building, does that cause the receivers to overload, like in a digital radio, a digital world, where if you have too much waveform, data waveform, whatever you want to call it, that it just can't handle it?
I don't know the answer to that question. I haven't personally been involved in any place where the radios are very, very close to the transmitter sites like you are. I've been more on the transmission side than the receiver side, so I'm sorry I can't help you with that. But I can get back to you with an answer.
I'd be curious.
Yeah, so would I. I haven't experienced a problem with the AM or the FM, but it'd be interesting to see what it does to the waveform when it hits the radio.
Good Jeff Detweiler question.
Oh, yes. Jeff hasn't been able to give me a straight answer yet. On the record, that is. Off the record, that's a whole different story.
Well, Hal, we sure thank you for joining us on This Week in Radio Tech. And as usual, you know, an hour is just enough time to scratch the surface of any of these subjects. Hal, would you like to recommend for additional reading or information where our listeners could go to understand better some of these issues and solutions that are facing HD radio broadcasters? Where could they go?
Well, there is some basic information on the Ibiquiti website, which is ibiquity.com. And all of the transmitter manufacturers have published papers and other information. So Nautel, Nautel.com, has a papers section under HD radio, and you're free to download that. And, of course, anyone who wishes to contact me directly, I will be happy to questions.
Yeah, I'm looking at that now, the HD radio white papers. You have some nice sections here, including a report on a station that I know has been had a long time relationship with Nautel, and that's KUVO in Colorado. I've been to their transmitter site, so you have a white paper on their particular situation and the challenges that were faced and what was done to meet those challenges.
Yes, that was a satellite-delivered situation, and he's using the reliable STL transport, HD radio transport there, to mitigate issues with satellite reception to feeding several stations that are not able to be fed by standard line-of-sight STLs.
Very cool. Well, gentlemen, thank you all for joining us, and listeners, thank you for joining us. Please tell your friends about This Week in Radio Tech. And please come back and join us again next week. We do a new podcast every week, and we try to have somebody interesting like Hal Neller this week from Nautel. Hal, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Tom Ray from New York, thanks for joining us this week.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me back, Kirk.
Chris Tobin from CBS Radio in New York. Thanks you for joining us, Chris.
You're very welcome.
And Chris Tarr from Milwaukee. Appreciate you being with us also.
Pleasure as always.
Well, all of you, thanks for tuning in, and please download our podcast again next week. Tell your friends. We do have listeners all around the world. In fact, got to tell you, I was in Hong Kong last week and met a wonderful engineer by the name of Tim Chan. Tim is the engineer for Metro Broadcast in Hong Kong, and he's responsible for the operation of, I don't know, about six radio stations and one television cable network. And he listens to our broadcast, so a big shout-out to Tim Chan. Thanks for listening, and sure appreciate your hospitality while I was in Hong Kong. Thanks again, everybody, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another twirt has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.